Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How stable are American auto companies after the rocky years of the recession? It's hard to forget the drubbing the CEOs took on Capitol Hill in the fall of 2008 when they went cap in hand to request billions of dollars in loans to keep their operations going. For Chrysler and General Motors, those humiliations before Congress were just the beginning, as both accepted billions in federal aid and still had to file for bankruptcy. So how did the American auto industry go so far off course? And is it too early to assume the ground the big three have regained since reorganizing and streamlining will be enough to ensure their survival into the future? Business reporter Bill Vlasic is Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times. His new book is called Once Upon a Car, The Fall and Resurrection of America's Big Three Automakers, GM, Ford, and Chrysler. Bill, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you, Chris. Glad to be here.
Now, I realize this could take the whole hour, but we should start briefly by talking about how the auto industry got itself into such a mess, which had begun to reveal itself long before the bottom dropped out of the U.S. economy in 2008. Can you talk a little bit about what went wrong?
Well, it was sort of a slow-acting poison in the U.S. auto industry of costs and volume and production that was tied to their size of years ago. In the heyday of the 60s and 70s, General Motors and Ford and Chrysler accounted for close to 90% of the vehicles sold in this country. To trying to grapple with hundreds of thousands of retirees, their pensions, their health care, I think the figure was GM was spending $1 on health care for every dollar it spent on capital expenditures for over 10 years. Hmm. It led to a company that thought they had to keep doing more volume to keep up with their obligations, with minimal profit margins, and sort of no regard in some respect to what the consumers really wanted. These companies lived off of large SUVs and trucks in the 90s, and not so much neglected the car side of the equation as they didn't put the same amount of investment and effort into it, and just ceded that part of the market to Toyota and Honda and others. Well, when the economic crisis hit the auto industry in the summer of 2008 and car sales fell off a cliff, General Motors in particular was totally unprepared for the demands on its own cash. And in a matter of months, they went from being a relatively healthy company, still losing money, still spending more than they were taking in, but with a substantial cash cushion, to a company that was about to run out of money in 60 days. Hmm. At which point, Wall Street was in the midst of its own financial crisis and wanted nothing to do with lending money to any corporation, but much less a struggling car company from Detroit. And pretty soon the options withered, and General Motors' underlying financial disaster was exposed for everyone to see in Congress.
You write, I think it's in the start of your second chapter, that by 2005, GM was running out of lots to park its unsold vehicles. Why were they overproducing so much? There's sort of a complicated formula that goes into why they kept making more cars than they could sell.
Well, this is an industry dominated in many ways by the United Auto Workers Union. They have pattern bargaining with all three Detroit automakers and have the same contracts, same labor costs, the same work rules for many, many years. That when it was sort of an oligopoly and they had 90% of the market, they could find ways to make profits under those circumstances. But when the competition got tougher and the people realized that a car built by Toyota in the United States was just as good as a car built by Toyota in Japan, only for far less labor costs than the American car companies, that advantage was huge. In many ways, shutting plants is sort of the underlying tragedy of my book, because hundreds of thousands of Americans lost their jobs in the auto industry since 2005. But for many years, that was kind of like the elephant in the room. How do we bring down production without risking a strike, which could put us out of business, without risking letting one of our competitors gain an advantage on us. And so it's a little bit like when you head down the wrong road and you keep going down it and you realize the trailhead that you originally chose is way back there now. It takes a lot of guts and some real strong management and in many cases a crisis to change that dynamic.
I think the book was also a revelation to me in terms of the really unique culture, corporate culture of Detroit, because obviously the big three are in direct competition with one another. But as you mentioned, they have similar issues with labor and costs and dealing with the United Auto Workers, and therefore they have some shared interests and at times really have needed to collaborate.
They've collaborated civilly over the years when they had a common enemy, whatever that might be. Japanese imports, for example, in the 70s, or environmentalists who were demanding better fuel economy from vehicles, or even political figures from states with right-to-work laws who were anti-union. They would collaborate, they would stick together, but they were kind of fighting. I used to say they're like kids in the same house, you know, they live by the house rules. When Toyota and Honda and now Hyundai began changing those rules and showing that Americans didn't look down on foreign cars, in fact, the opposite. They preferred them in many cases. It was a bitter pill for Detroit to swallow. If you look back, Detroit really believes it created the auto industry. You might get an argument from some of the Germans about creating the automobile, but the modern auto industry was created by Henry Ford in the 1920s, and old habits die hard, and that feeling of not so much superiority, but pride of authorship, and what's worked for us in the past was good enough, will work for us now. Very, very dangerous in Detroit, and outsiders who would come here occasionally in high positions did not last long. They sort of chewed them up and spit them out at GM because they weren't one of us, if you will. In many ways, this book is about how the big three kind of finally broke apart after all these years, with General Motors and Chrysler going one way into bankruptcy and government bailout, and Ford Motor Company, for many reasons, going in another direction, but primarily because their chairman and patriarch, Bill Ford, had the foresight and the humility to hire an outsider to run the Ford Motor Company, who questioned so many of these things that were taken as truths around here.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because Bill Ford's ascension to the helm of his family's historically held company had been a sort of victory in many ways. However, he was able to begin recognizing that he needed help. One of the things he did was approach this firebrand Jim Farley, who at first seemed a very unlikely candidate to leave his job at Toyota in marketing. What convinced Farley to finally jump to a struggling domestic manufacturer from a Japanese company that he had loved working for?
Well, Jim Farley is an extraordinary salesman and marketing executive, and had been extremely successful at Toyota. It was sort of fortunate for Ford Motor Company that he had deep Ford ties in his family. His grandfather was actually an assembly line worker in Detroit back in the days of Henry Ford, and half of his family lived in Michigan. So he had being a car guy who grew up in that environment, a sentimental, emotional attachment. That being said, people don't change great jobs because of emotions, usually. They change because of opportunity. And I believe that Farley was prescient enough to see that the Ford Motor Company was not that far behind Toyota in quality, despite what people thought. And there were some very driven engineers and marketing people and executives and workers at the Ford Motor Company who were tired of losing and wanted to reclaim Ford's status as a premier automaker in the world. The talent was never really missing at Ford. What happened was the company became a follower instead of a leader. And unfortunately, they followed General Motors. These companies moved in lockstep in terms of their, not just their labor contracts and their factories, but the products they made. and the way they marketed them. That's why it drives people sometimes crazy at the individual companies here when my editors at the Times like me to talk about Detroit. They like to distinguish between Ford and GM, but for most of America, people think of it as a, like you think of Wall Street or Hollywood, that they're all sort of marching to their own tune. And Jim Farley brought not only the perspective of how to serve the customer that Toyota was has been so good at for so many years, despite their recent troubles with recalls, he also brought an energy and an emotion into Ford that I think he saw was missing at Toyota, that the one thing that the Detroit veterans really had was a lot of pride and a desire to win. Nobody wants to lose. People get tired of it after a while. And it was kind of a very nice match that Bill Ford was looking for someone who not only knew how Toyota did it, but was willing and anxious to bring that to an American company as well.
Ford also eventually recognized that he needed to replace himself as president and CEO, but he wanted to remain on as chairman of the board. Talk about how that affected his search for new talent in the CEO's position.
It made it very difficult at first because the Ford Motor Company is different. It is still controlled by the heirs of Henry Ford through a special class of stock that they own, which gives them 40% voting control. That's how Bill Ford became the chairman and chief executive. His family supported him, and he's very capable, well-educated, and dedicated executive in his own right. But it's somewhat unique for a CEO of a company of this size to publicly sort of admit that this is not what I'm best at. I'm not a turnaround artist. I'm not an executive with the kind of experience and perhaps that inner fortitude to start closing these plants, to say to his teams of product development people, we're going to do less trucks and more cars. It's a big leap of faith. And maybe people around here weren't willing to hear that out of Bill Ford's mouth. They needed to hear it from somebody like Alan Mulally, who questioned all the old rules and challenged the people at Ford to do things differently and not sort of embrace this history at the peril of falling behind.
So Mulally obviously had left Boeing for Ford. What kinds of changes did he start to make when he arrived?
Well, Ford has a very Byzantine culture of, as Bill Ford would say, we're known, I think I have as a quote in the book, Bill Ford's GM is known for its arrogance. We're known for our infighting. Ford was, and of course the Ford family added to the drama. Covered several regimes at Ford, and it's not a company that takes criticism well. It's not a company that changes direction once they've made up their mind. And Alan Mulally had all the technical expertise to do well in this job. He was the head of airplane development for Boeing, so he knows a bit about big, complicated, long-term machines that you have to develop and take years and the money. But the fact is he came here and he sort of decided to go back to the basics at Ford, which is a good thing.
Bill Vlasic is my guest. He's Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times and author of the new book Once Upon a Car, The Fall and Resurrection of America's Big Three Automakers, GM, Ford, and Chrysler. We'll take your calls right after the break. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning. You can gain a professional advantage with SMU's 9-month intensive CFP program starting in Plano this January. Learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with the Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times, Bill Vlasic. His new book is called Once Upon a Car, The Fall and Resurrection of America's Big Three Automakers, GM, Ford, and Chrysler. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. And that's where we hear from Thomas in Dallas. Hi, Thomas.
Yeah, I was going to say that looking at the pension obligations of the big three, you have to go back to 1975 when all their chief executives went before Congress and begged them to let Congress not fund their pensions for a few years. The chief executives didn't take a pay cut, but they didn't fund the pensions. To look at unfunded pensions and say, boy, when they come, you know, mature, that they weren't funded properly, you can't take that out of the equation. Also, in 2008, there was a survey done of American manufacturing that would include domestic and foreign producers here in America. And there was about a $2 per hour difference in hourly compensation. But what they also found was 9 of the top 10 were all big three manufacturers in production and per labor hour and all that. And number 10 was a Toyota-GM joint venture. Much of the corrections happened before these companies collapsed. It just was too little too late. And the big difference between Ford and the others is they mortgaged their nameplate to borrow, $20 billion in cash about 2 months before the collapse. And that's the whole difference. And, in fact, the GM and Chrysler are in better shape because they were able to through bankruptcy, discharge many of their obligations, where Ford still beholden to those.
Well, let's get a response to you brought up a lot of things, Thomas. First of all, Bill, what about that pension issue?
Well, the pensions at the big three were unsustainable. It's remarkable how many people who have read the book have mentioned it. They sort of see it as a microcosm of entitlements and the discussion that's going on at a national level. The fact is they would do well funding their pensions when the market was good, and when the market wasn't good, their investments went down and their pensions became underfunded. But it was the old shoveling sand at the beach. It was never ending. Healthcare, in fact, was even more onerous, only because of the rising size of the rising costs. Mm-hmm. And the companies tried to address these structural obligations in piecemeal. In 2007, in the big labor talks, they carved off all the retiree health care benefits into a trust. Of course, incredibly expensive to fund those trusts. I look back on those days now when GM agreed to put close to $30 billion into a trust for retirees is almost playing with monopoly money. Where that $30 billion was going to come from was anyone's guess, but they had to go through the motions to try and come up with a solution to prevent healthcare and pensions from just eating every single penny of profits that they were struggling to make to begin with. So it was too little too late. I'm not quite sure when they could have addressed this. I'm not a macro economist, but the fact is it becomes very difficult to have a company where you're supporting 2.5 retirees and surviving spouses for each active worker you have. I'm not sure any company or any industry is capable of doing that. And that goes to the second part of the gentleman's question about costs. Yes, they were higher. There's no question about it. The American Auto Worker and the UAW have leveraged out some excellent health care plans over the years, excellent pensions, excellent work rules, more vacation days than most of us get. These are hard jobs. They require a lot of commitment to do them well, but they are, I would call them skilled labor, but they're manual labor. But the fact is their health benefits were better than anybody on the block and always have been. And I think that was somewhat why the animosity that came gushing out in those hearings 3 years ago in Congress, that was sort of the source of it. Like, why do they deserve that much more? Why is their paycheck that much bigger than mine? Why is their health care plan that much better than mine? And by the way, my car doesn't always work. So all that negative sort of perception all was lumped together in sort of overpaid auto workers.
Well, caring for employee health is something that I know Henry Ford sort of pioneered when it wasn't common in any industry for employers to provide for their employees' health care. Is it too simplistic to blame the UAW alone for the size of these benefits and plans?
I certainly wouldn't blame them. I'm very familiar with the origins of the UAW. Have been a union member myself for quite a number of years, and I worked at the Detroit News here in Detroit. The fact is, 50, 60 years ago, conditions in auto plants were pretty dangerous. And the union fought long and hard to get recognized and then to bring up the standard of living of its workers, and in many cases was a model for other unions in this country. I think the issue crystallized, though, with the retirees. When we talk about the average cost of labor in an American car, you include, of course, the people who put it together, but you have to include that every dollar you take out of that or put into that car that's for the health care of someone who worked at GM 25 years ago, that's a different matter. And those costs could not be borne by the sort of the conventional build a car, sell it, make a profit. The other point that was brought up was about Ford and its borrowing, which was actually in 2006. Shortly after Alan Mulally joined the company, they borrowed $23 billion. It will go down in history as the single most important move that kept Ford out of bankruptcy and not requiring support from the taxpayers. However, at the time, and I remember it well, people thought this was a sign of desperation. Oh, my God, Ford is mortgaging their headquarters building, the blue oval symbol, all their patents, all their trademarks to borrow money. They must be in really big trouble. Well, General Motors chose not to go into the market and borrow then. And when they did go in 2008, they found that nobody on Wall Street really wanted to even talk to them at that point. So you look back and you say that was that a great idea? Yeah, but at the time it was a risky one. And I'm not sure without Bill Ford and Alan Mulally sort of taking this entire step-back approach to what do we need to do to fix this enterprise, that would have happened. They may have borrowed $10 billion instead of $23. That's how challenging the environment was. If that's what they had done, they wouldn't have made it.
Why was Rick Wagoner, then CEO of GM, so opposed to a potential merger deal with Renault-Nissan, which could potentially have spared GM from its bankruptcy declaration in the same way that borrowing money spared Ford?
Well, that's a good question. GM, unfortunately, I think was inflicted with the not invented here syndrome. Mm-hmm. You know, they saw this as a power play by Kirk Kerkorian, the billionaire investor who at that time owned close to 10% of the company, and his chief advisor, Jerry York, who got on the GM board and began pressing for this not so much a merger, but GM becoming part of the international alliance of Nissan and Renault. They saw it as a threat. GM saw it as a threat. Mr. Kerkorian and Jerry York saw it as an opportunity. And unfortunately, General Motors was always good at making a case for what they believed in. And they believed that these two companies were trying to piggyback on their enormous size and their global reach and this entire fortress mentality of General Motors as the biggest, the best auto company in the world, which, by the way, most people didn't really see them that way. Certainly the biggest, but not the best. But within GM, there was a mindset that we don't admit mistakes at General Motors, and we don't need help at General Motors. And unfortunately, that is not the mindset to have when you're going to Congress and asking for help, number one. And number two, when you're trying to survive. Maybe when you want to dominate, maybe when you're looking to expand, but when you're trying to survive, you have to be open to these type of game-changing events.
Well, it sounds here, Bill, like to the same extent that a measure of humility ultimately saved Ford, it was hubris that brought GM to its knees.
That's a good way of putting it. GM, what astonished me when I researched the book, and I've been covering the industry for a long time, so I was on the daily coverage all through this.
Yeah.
And it was an extraordinary series of events that all of a sudden General Motors was going to Washington and not only asking for a bailout, although they never used that word, they hated that word, they saw themselves as different than the banks. It's all the economy's fault. In fact, it's even Wall Street's fault because they won't lend us the money. But they went down there to ask for assistance without a plan and expecting the Congress and the Bush administration first and then the Obama administration to respond to them for one reason. If you don't, the economy is going to tumble into chaos. General Motors goes into bankruptcy. Hundreds of thousands of jobs are lost. An extremely fragile economy could topple into recession. But I still, to this day, for a company that generates position papers and data and reams of marketing to get you to buy their products, did not even have a PowerPoint that was convincing to the U.S. Congress that they should help the company.
And initially, the opinion from Henry Paulson was, even if we wanted to, we have no authority under TARP to give you auto companies any money.
Yes, Paulson was not empathetic whatsoever. He was a little busy trying to
keep
the world's economy from collapsing based on the severe situation with Lehman Brothers and the rest of the banks on Wall Street to deal with this. And coming in unannounced when you're already in a huge crisis with no preparation, not good business. I still don't really understand how GM went down there without a game plan, led the entire industry down there, by the way. Ford and Chrysler sort of followed them. Neither one of those two could have done this on their own. This was GM's show. And the fact of the matter is GM was not fixable at that point. And to the credit, I guess, of the Congress, they realized that if they wrote GM a check, not even one that's on the scale of what they were doing for AIG or the banks, they might never see that money again. So it was left really, first the Bush administration to give them the emergency funding, and that was really the president's call. I think he's made that clear in his book, and Henry Paulson went along with it. Philosophically, it did not sound like he was on the same page there, but he went along with it because it was a crisis atmosphere. And President Bush, I think, said in his book he promised he wouldn't leave this situation for Obama to deal with without at least giving GM enough money to carry them over. But then he had to look at the real fundamentals here, and I think it became very clear very quickly that GM just had to get very much smaller very quickly, and even then it was still a 50-50 proposition if money would fix it.
So we haven't talked much here today about Chrysler, which was merged into Daimler Chrysler at the time of the meltdown. But Daimler, it seems like from the start, had really skimped on investing in its American holdings.
Well, the German leadership of Daimler became very uncomfortably aware of the exposure that Daimler, which is the preeminent industrial company sort of in Germany, was very much tied to the fortunes of Chrysler in the American market, and got their stockholders, their leadership, their unions became justifiably concerned after 7 or 8 years of this merger that Chrysler had the potential to bring down Daimler, which is something that they could not allow to happen. Yes, they did pour money in. I covered the Daimler-Chrysler merger. In fact, I wrote another book 10 years ago called Taken for a Ride, about Daimler buying Chrysler, and I think it's simplistic to say that Daimler didn't put money into it or Daimler didn't want it to succeed. Believe me, they tried very hard. They just wanted to do it on their own terms. And the Germans build Mercedes-Benzes. They don't build Dodge Ram pickups.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different world. There was a bad match between the companies. But it is correct to say once they realized they were going to get out of Chrysler and they had to get rid of it, they didn't spend any more money. And car companies that don't spend money on product, good times or bad times, are in real trouble because this is a fast-moving, competitive business. Cars that were new this year are going to be out of date in a couple. And if you don't have something provocative and improved to replace them with, your market share can go down very, very quickly.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Jim on the line in Dallas. Hey, Jim.
Hi, thanks very much. First of all, I was going to ask you, I recall sometime 5 to 7 years ago that Fortune magazine had a cover article saying General Motors is going to go bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
And this is long before the crash of 07. And it outlined a distinct set of events that were going to take place that seemed to have taken place. And also, I know that General Motors became involved in the credit card market, in the mortgage market, in the derivatives market. They had pretty high exposure in that. How much of that affected them?
Well, I remember that cover story very well. In fact, it's referenced in the book. It was called it was an all-black cover with a headline that said, "The Tragedy of General Motors." It was sort of like an obituary. Actually, GM at the time was expecting Fortune to validate their new turnaround plan. Instead, they were prescient and called it like they saw it, which was this company can't sustain itself.
Let me have you pause right here because we're going to take a quick break, and that way you'll have time to fully answer the question in a moment.
Fine, thank you.
My guest this hour is Bill Vlasic. He's Detroit Bureau Chief for the New York Times and author of the new book, Once Upon a Car, The Fall and Resurrection of America's Big Three Automakers, GM, Ford, and Chrysler. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Certificate Program in Financial Planning. You can gain a professional advantage with SMU's 9-month intensive CFP program starting in Plano this January. Learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. New York Times Detroit Bureau Chief Bill Vlasic is my guest this hour. His new book is called Once Upon a Car, The Fall and Resurrection of America's Big Three Automakers. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. So before the break, Bill, we had this call from Jim referring to the article in Fortune magazine, the cover story, The Tragedy of General Motors. That was 2006, is that right?
As I recall, and it was pretty hard hitting, very analytical, and as at the time, roundly discounted by all the General Motors executives as being shrill and hysteric and never could happen in a million years. Now, I guess when you're threatened like that and called out, your first reaction is to shoot the messenger. But that was Carol Loomis, who is one of their most distinguished writers at Fortune. Her name was kind of a dirty word around GM for a while, but she should feel vindicated today because a lot of what she said was exactly on target, particularly the unsustainability of the legacy costs. And the gentleman who brought that up also mentioned how General Motors was deeply involved in the credit market, which is quite true. For several years, actually, in the last decade, almost all of GM's profits, other than they were getting from some international markets, came from its credit side of the business. A lot of that was cheap leases for cars, but it was very diversified, and they were heavily into mortgages, and it came back to bite them in a big, big way. And even though they at one point spun off their credit business and only took a half ownership, those what had been profits during sort of the go-go years of housing and credit became big losses very quickly and compounded their troubles, because the fact is there was no way to stop that. They were stuck with a lot of bad mortgages and a lot of bad car leases that they just had to write off, and you can't get money out of people who can't pay it. And it was just another log on the fire for GM to burn away at.
By the way, why did GM spinning off Delphi, which makes auto parts, in the late 90s, not save it the kind of money that it had anticipated?
You know, I mean, at one time years ago, it was a huge advantage to GM to be vertically integrated.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they could control the process all the way through. They owned these parts companies. They used to sew their own seat covers. They did make their own spark plugs, all these parts of the car. And in the old era, that was an advantage. They could control the quality. They could control the supply. They could actually sell their parts to other automakers. But it became very clear that their competitors in the supplier business were not paying $25, $26, $27 an hour to their workers. People who were sewing seat covers for companies in Mexico were doing it for far less money.
Mm-hmm.
So GM tried to insulate itself from its union contracts, which were the same for the people in the assembly plants where the cars are actually produced as they were for the people making spark plugs in Flint, Michigan, which could not compete anymore with Chinese-made spark plugs or spark plugs made in Brazil. I use spark plugs just because it's kind of a part that people know about. And the fact is they did try and distance themselves from Delphi. Again, GM wanted it to have its cake and eat it too. They didn't want the legal and financial responsibility for Delphi, but they still wanted the parts. Delphi was sort of the canary in the coal mine, if you will, for the collapse of the industry, because they went bankrupt in 2006, and it became very clear that the labor cost issue that took them into bankruptcy, for better or for worse, no judgment made on my part if they could have done it sooner or later, but the fact is that's what took them into bankruptcy, repeated itself a few years later with the car makers themselves.
So what kinds of discussions were there among the leaders of the Big Three on the eve of their trip to Washington to talk to Congress about emergency funding?
That's another thing that stunned me. None. None at all. Even on the day that they were going to go to the Senate hearing, Rick Wagner had a brief phone conversation with Alan Mulally at Ford and Bob Nardelli, who was the CEO at Chrysler, and there was no coordination, no discussion who should say what. And it was a sort of the ultimate awkward moment. Here we are. We're down here. In a couple hours, we're walking into a Senate hearing room. And we don't even know each other that well, much less have a coordinated game plan. I'm sure looking back, people would say that should have been done differently. But unfortunately, you get to that point because General Motors was acting on its own. And, in fact, as we sort of reveal in the book, they had even approached Ford about a merger a couple months earlier, which was totally out of left field, and mm-hmm. Ford wanted no part of it. But it just showed the kind of desperation and making it up as you go along scenarios that were happening at General Motors. I was surprised when I asked that question. Did you talk? Did you meet? Strategize? No, no, and no.
Why did Mulally go up or down to Washington at all if he was relatively certain that Ford would not take government funding?
That's a very good question. At the time, the first approach that GM made in Washington was to try and get its hands on some Department of Energy loans, $25 billion, which was money that they thought they could access early. It was really totally intended to help the companies meet fuel economy standards. They ran into a brick wall there because Nancy Pelosi was not interested in diverting money for fuel-efficient cars into propping up GM's balance sheet. But the fact is, Mullally had to go down there at first because the specter of GM collapsing would have put Ford in a very difficult position. They shared a lot of the same suppliers. If GM went down and their suppliers went down, what happens to Ford production? He went down there to look out for his interests, look out for Ford's interests. And the market was getting, the auto market was collapsing so quickly, I also believe they weren't sure how bad things were going to get and that, in fact, they might need that money. But as soon as they saw that what was happening and that you would have to basically cede control of your company, which is what General Motors did. They gave up control in exchange for the government bailout, whether it was management control or decisions about bankruptcy. It was, all the shots were being called in Washington. Once Mullally saw that, he didn't want to go back at all, and he didn't. And his appearance at the first couple hearings are almost something that, you know, he looks back on as, boy, I'm glad I got out of there as quickly as I possibly could.
So Ford is now making money. GM is somewhat profitable. Chrysler is hiring again. Are they out of the woods?
You know, these in General Motors' case, it's an entirely different company than it was 3 years ago. It's half as big, half as many brands, half as many models, half as many dealers.
No more Hummer, no more Saturn, no more...
no more Pontiac. Uh-huh. People... That's you know, at GM for years the idea of getting rid of Pontiac was considered ridiculous. My God, it's Pontiac. Of course, this is a division that sold 350,000 cars a year and did not make any money. Hmm. Not many companies would continue in that with a product line that sizable that wasn't making money. But the fact of the matter is, General Motors has a balance sheet now that is light years better than it was 2 and 3 years ago. One of the callers mentioned about getting out from under their debt obligations. They have a very clean balance sheet, a lot of taxpayer cash in the bank. I'd remind your listeners that the American taxpayer still owns 26% of General Motors, and the cash reserves that GM is spending now are all based on its loans from the Treasury Department. That being said, it made so much sense and should have been done a long time sooner to, as Lee Iacocca used to say, dump the losers, meaning if a car is not making it after a few years, don't make it again. GM was famous for doing that. Now they have a smaller product line, more dedicated focus to passenger cars and not just trucks. And, in fact, their quality has been steadily improving over the years, and it's not that far behind the market leaders. And so I think that GM has sort of a clean slate. And from my own observation, there are no excuses at GM anymore. They should make money now. They were the recipient of the most extensive government bailout in the history of the auto industry anywhere. And they should be able... under the circumstances, if the market continues to get a little better in cars, which it has been, it's a bright spot in the economy right now, actually, General Motors should be able to be a profitable company and one that can continue to serve the customers. And if they don't, I guess shame on them.
What sort of shot in the arm was the Cash for Clunkers trade-in program?
Yeah, that was really interesting. Cash for Clunkers... sort of got lost in the shuffle of the bailouts there for a while, but it was a shot in the arm, and what it did was not only did it take a lot of gas guzzlers off the road and sort of provide a stimulus for the market in general, I think it also opened some eyes that there were a lot of people out there who would like to get rid of their guzzlers, would like to move into something smaller, and would be happy with a a four-door compact sedan instead of a truck-based sport utility vehicle if it fills their needs. It not only sort of injected some life into the market in terms of sales. Ironically, Toyota participated in more cash for clunkers trade-in than any other company, with Ford second. But it also kind of validated that consumers will buy and be proud to own smaller vehicles that work well and fit their needs, and they don't need multi-ton, seven-passenger vehicles that consume an awful lot of gas and can be very expensive to own.
And salaries, what are the pay rates like since the restructuring and renegotiation of GM and Chrysler in particular?
Well, GM, because it's still has a government ownership situation, is under restrictions on what they can pay their executives, and that's going to last until every last share is sold. They claim it's hurting them somewhat on recruiting people, but that's that comes with the territory. Ford, on the other hand, is very profitable right now, and Mr. Mullally and Mr. Ford have made many millions of dollars in the last year or so, which has almost backfired in these latest contract talks with the UAW, who did give up, make a lot of concessions during the tough times, and now want some back. So I just covered the story yesterday of the new Ford UAW contract, and they got some fairly generous bonuses to sign their contract, more so than GM. But I think that with GM, it's going to take a while before the government gets out still. So for the time being, I think Americans may rest assured they're not overpaying the GM executives. Market forces are sort of under the control of the fact that they can't give raises, and maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that's part of that humility that took GM so long to absorb.
At what point will you be able to say that the companies are certainly out of the woods, rather?
Well, I think the biggest problems with all three of these companies were their North American sales.
Mm-hmm.
They were losing share in their home market, and they weren't making any money. That's been changed. That was the big festering wound. They are making money in North America. The Chevrolet Cruze, GM's new small car, is the top-selling passenger car in the United States, and it's been a long time that Toyota didn't have that title, or Honda.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. We are out of time. Bill Vlasic is Detroit Bureau Chief for the New York Times and author of Once Upon a Car, The Fall and Resurrection of America's Big Three Automakers. Bill, it's been a really interesting discussion. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Oh, thanks, Chris. I really appreciate it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.